So as Michael mentioned this morning, we have a guest preacher with us. And can I call you that, preacher? We'll see. Gary Moore, we are blessed to have him with us, and I'm going to explain who he is, but just the sovereignty of God, alive and well, powerful on this particular day when this whole thing began to happen, and the way that it happened, Andy Gerd, who is an elder, wave to everybody, Andy. Andy is an elder here at NAPC, and he, at an event for his work, he met Gary Moore, and the two started talking, and talked about their faith, and then kind of one thing led to another, and I had a conversation with Gary, and then we were able to set this up. Now, we know that the sovereignty of God was alive in that day and powerful, because not only did Andy and Gary connect, but they connected, of course, at the Sugar Bowl, Alabama and Ohio State game. So we see the sovereignty of God alive in so many ways that day and place, and just a wonderful, wonderful thing. So Gary Moore is the director of the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections that represents the largest single line item budget in the state of Ohio. He was appointed by Governor John Kasich in January of 2011, and he has a 40-year career in corrections. He's worked both in the public and private sectors. He comes to us along with his wife, Linda, of 43 years. She is here as well. Their daughter, Stacy, as well. There are also several staff that work with Gary that are here, that are visiting us, and just so blessed that you are here and grateful to God for your presence here. And so we are really blessed to have him here. I'm going to read the scriptures, and then Gary will come up and he will preach. So pull out that handout that you got when you came into church this morning. There are four scriptures. The first one is from the Gospel of John, chapter 13, verses 34 and 35. This is Jesus speaking. He says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." The second reading is from the New Testament book of Hebrews, chapter 13, verse 3. "Remember those who are in prison as though in prison with them, and those who are mistreated, since you also are in the body." The third reading is, again, Jesus speaking in Matthew chapter 25, verse 35. "For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me." And then finally, from Romans chapter 5, verse 8. "But God shows his love for us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." This is the word of the Lord.
I bounced back and forth in the first session, so we'll see how this goes. But I want to thank everyone in this church for the welcome that we've received, Lyndon, Stacy, and my staff. And I appreciate that they're doing double service here. Listen to me twice in the same sermon. I don't know. That's going above and beyond. And Pastor, let me ask you this. You required the middle school and high school students to stay in here. Did they do something wrong? Did they got to listen to me? Is that a sanction? I don't know what it is. But thank you. And Andy, I wouldn't be here without you. Thank you. It was a great day on so many levels. I'm not sure the Crimson Tide can say that, but it was on so many levels. Brett Poore, who I'll tell you, I do a lot of work. He's everywhere, by the way, in the prison fellowship. There he is. But he is everywhere, and he's supportive so much of what we're doing. And this is the first time, I think, Brett, you've ever seen me with any notes at all, because I usually don't have them. And I'll probably abandon them before we're done here. But it's been a great thing, and I appreciate my family and the staff. And I wanted to bring the staff here particularly, and I didn't ask them to, they came. And we had more of them here in the first service. But I wanted to, because it's important that you feel comfortable with us. And there's some great folks here, and they want to be part of a relationship with you, and we'll talk about that in a bit. As I said in the first service, one, I feel an awesomeness today. Ed Banks left with his daughter, and he said, "Boss," he says, "this is really a great day." And he meant it. kids, this is a great day to be alive, and I also understand the awesome responsibility of giving a message. It seemed like a great idea about 4, 5, 6 months ago when we talked. This last week, I had started not knowing. I don't know whether this is good or not, but it is. And I've got to say, Pastor David's got to, he must be really secure in his role here to have me up front. That's all I can say. So, but let's begin with prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for this great opportunity to be here and to share and to talk about a journey that's become my calling. Guide my words to reflect that this message is about service to others and is not about me. Let us understand that this is a great day to be alive, because all of us have the opportunity to make this even better, a better world tomorrow for so many others. We pray that these words spoken during this service and a meditation of our hearts are acceptable to you. Amen. I'm from a small town, some of you may know it, up the road in Marion County, a town called Prospect, Ohio, 1,200 people. And I'm an only child, had a mother and father, and I enjoyed sports, most like most of the folks in my age. And at that time, it was baseball, right? So I played a lot of baseball. And I became a pretty good baseball player primarily because of my mom. My mom had me out. We had a vacant lot across where we grew up, and she had me out, and she was throwing pitches, and she was hitting me ground balls and fly balls all the time until we got exhausted. And she was really just critical to do that. And if I wasn't in that Prospect Park over there playing baseball, usually with older kids, then I was with my mom, who really was my best friend. And I was growing up, things were progressing along in pretty good manner, pretty good fashion. I got pretty good grades. And I was always the cleanup hitter on all our baseball teams, regardless of how old the other kids were. You know, my mom never missed a ball game. She never missed a school event, even when I was in these musical things and I was terrible. And she always baked cookies and baked goods to give to the teachers to ensure that somehow I became the teacher's pet. And for some reason, that was important to me. So I remember that. Halfway through my 15th year on this earth, my mom got really sick. She had a cancerous brain tumor. And back then, you know, in the late 60s, we didn't have the technology and there was surgery. And my mom was pretty deformed, but she was still my best friend, And she died shortly after I turned 16. And I remember that day. I remember everything about that day, everything. I remember who came to the service. I remember people trying to help me out of the church. And I also remember the people gathered at my aunt's house, and I couldn't stay there. I had to walk. I had to get away because I didn't want to hear anyone laugh. That was not a time for laughter for me. So, life went on, but my life was about to change pretty dramatically then, in just about every aspect except I could still play baseball, thanks to Mom. And in fact, my mom's effort and everything that she did to help me play baseball saved my life, because it prepared me to meet a really caring teacher, my high school baseball coach, that was so instrumental in saving my life. You know, I haven't mentioned my father, have I? I didn't have a relationship with my father. I was an only child. And when Mom died, I would see my dad maybe every few days. I wouldn't see him every day. But I had a job. I got a job. I was pumping gas for those younger folks, the middle schoolers and high schoolers that were required to stay here and listen to me. We actually pumped gas and worked at that and changed oil in these gas stations. And I prayed that nobody came in with a car problem that was more difficult than an oil change, because they were in real trouble if I was working. But I had a job and I had some money. And I really believed that children's services and shifted away. I had some money, I had some resources to be able to do that. My special distinction of being like a teacher's pet and favored by the teachers faded away too. In fact, the high school guidance counselor told me, he said, Gary, you'd be wasting your time to even apply for college. You'll never make it. And based on my performance, she's probably right. My goal to play Major League Baseball, the Philadelphia Phillies, had scouted me, but my goal was shattered too. My senior year against Bishop Watterson, the state high school baseball tournament, I was catching and I became pretty severely cleated and ended up in a wheelchair. And then that was gone. I was in a state of depression and despair. I will tell you, my actions and behaviors, my mom would have been crushed. I was spending time with those older boys doing things that, quite frankly, would have led me to a path to prison, not as an employee, but as an inmate. I can remember just skipping school and not going to school because my dad wasn't around. I didn't go to school. But I was always at the mailbox, right? So when the school letters came about my poor attendance records and requesting a conference with me, I was able to snatch those out. So my father never got a hold of those. So life was going on, and ultimately, it caused me to rethink. Let me say this. In Romans, God shows his love for us in that while we are sinners, Christ died for us. God didn't give up on me. Should have. Didn't deserve it. And I think this passage and the experience of my life is God's greatest reflection of his belief in second chances for all of us. Matthew chapter 29, verse 35, I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me. Well, let me tell you this. God sent me help. God sent me help. First was that high school baseball teacher and this coach, Bill McElroy. He sat me down in that locker room and he said, listen, Gary, he said, things aren't going well. You need to be rethinking your life. And you need to be rethinking how you're doing this. And he said, you know, and forget about that Major League Baseball stuff. Forget about that baseball contract. He says, there's life beyond that. And he said, by the way, you probably wouldn't have made the majors anyway, which is probably true. And he set me down and he helped me get into the Ohio State University Marion campus that led me to teaching and led me to prison education and my first job in this business. Years later, when we're talking about this, he actually guided me into prison, saying, Gary, you may want to think about teaching in prison because, one, I think you've got a great background, and two, it'll remind you not to act the way you did before because you could see the path that you would be on. And he was right. Secondly, and I want to be clear about this, folks, this is second, but it's certainly not second priority, came my wife, Linda. You know, Linda and I both grew up in Prospect, 1,200 people, and I don't think we had a conversation throughout the whole high school years. And it wasn't until after we graduated with high school, and you might guess Linda graduated with a lot higher distinction than I did, that we started talking, and at the ages of 19 and 20, we got married. And Linda's been with me our entire journey. And if you've read anything about me in paper, it's not always good, is it? It's not always good about what we do, and I can't even comprehend how much London, our kids, Stacy, and our family had to endure some of the headlines about the prison system and me being director. She's been with me every step of the way in our faith journey in our church, a Lutheran church, albeit, but in a church, has strengthened me and has given me a sense of courage to do things that just haven't been maybe tried by other people. On July 1st, 1974, now I would typically at this point ask everyone who was not born on July 4th, 1974 to raise your hand, but I won't do that now. I do that with all the new employees. I talk to all of our new employees. We have 12,000 employees that work for us. And I talk to the new employees, every group that comes in, we spend an hour with them, I talk to them at the academy. And I tell this story about starting on July 1st, 1974. You know, I've always believed that people should have a second chance. I mean, I did, thanks to God, thanks to Bill McElroy, thanks to Linda. And I've always believed that the people that we serve should have that same opportunity. You know, as I started as a teacher, I was actually amazed that there are people three times my age that I was teaching letters of the alphabet that didn't know letters of the alphabet. And then eventually they learned to read. And it started to grow that it was really a powerful calling. And it became a calling. So how'd this guy that started from Prospect, Ohio, become director of a state agency? I have to kind of shake my head because I often don't remember how this all happened. But I retired once. I retired at the end of 2002 after a great career as a prison warden. And there's no better job, Ronnie, is there, than being a prison warden. There's not a better job in the world because you can make such great change. You can be courageous and do great things, and Ronnie is a great warden. And so it was a great time, but I retired in 2002, and I've always looked forward. I try never to look back, and I just can't look back very well. And I worked with the youth services for about 3 years as superintendent and did a few things there, and then Linda and I started our own consulting business, and we were able to travel the world, not that world, the United States. We were able to go to prisons in every state in this country and do things that were worthwhile. Start training programs, train staff, put unit management staff to work with inmates together. It was a wonderful one. To deal with staff culture was a wonderful life. And during that time, Linda and I built a place in Carolina, in the southeast corner of North Carolina, and we're there every month. We were there a few days every month. So selfishly, life after 2002 was really good. But then the calls came in December of 2010. We got three calls from Governor Kasich's transition committee. Three calls. They said, "Hey, Gary," "we're trying to figure out what we want to do with the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation Corrections. I think it needs to be reformed. The governor thinks it needs to be reformed. How about being a director?" And I said, "No, things are too good." I was selfish, and Linda was selfish, because I loved our life so much. Well, the fourth call, you know, there, after three, sometimes there's a fourth call. And this fourth call was one that was tough. The fourth call came and said, "Listen, the governor's been given, Governor Kasich's been given all these ideas about how to run the system. He's got these ideas he wants someone to bounce them off of, and you can kind of give him your opinion." Well, I'm pretty good at giving opinions now, except to Linda, but I'm pretty good with that. So I said, "Sure." And then he said, "Now, Gary, you only have 15 minutes, right? So 15 minutes, I'm good with." And Linda was all over it because we live in Chillicothe. "We'll go to Columbus, 15 minutes, and then we'll go to lunch." So Linda was all in. So I told you I was going to tell a story, Linda. So we go to Columbus, and the transition office before the governor took office, and this was, folks, this was December 27, 2010, what, 7 weeks after the election? So we walk in, and it's on the 19th floor of the Rice Center. His office is now on the 30th. The transition's office there. Well, there's a little soda shop and stuff on one end of the floor on the 19th floor. So I take Linda there, and I said, "Linda, we got 15 minutes. Don't make it a large soda. We only got 15 minutes." So Linda's at this side. So I go to the other end of the 19th floor, and I meet the governor. Now, remember, guys, this is powerful to me. I started at $2.54 an hour as a teacher's aide in 1974, and the governor now is asking me for advice. I mean, this was really a big deal. And I'd never met John Kasich. I walked in, and he looked just like he did on TV, you know. He didn't have the 20-pound game that I have when I'm on camera. So I shake his hand, and we had a conversation, and he says, "Gary, I only got 15 minutes." And I said, "I do know that. That was made very clear." He says, "Well, let me just start out with what we're going to do." I said, "Okay." He says, "Gary, what we're going to do," he says, "you know, we've got an $8 billion deficit in the budget. The agency's a big expenditure of funds. We've got to get our budget down. This is So what we're going to do is we're going to close about 5 to 6 prisons, we're thinking, and take about 10 to 12,000 inmates out of Ohio, out of those prisons that we close, and we're going to send them to the states of Oklahoma and Minnesota. And we're going to save money because these are private prisons, and what's going to happen is they're going to charge us this amount, and the per diem in our state facilities is this amount, and that gap is going to save us millions of dollars. What do you think? Well, much like I've already lost my place here, I'm not scripted. I said, Governor, I didn't think. I said, Governor, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard. True. And because I didn't think then, I started, and actually at that point he says, do you know who your boss is? And I said, it's not you, I haven't taken this job. And I had no desire or interest in taking that job at that moment. The 15 minutes grew to 3 hours. And it was debate, it was heated, it got to core values, it got to the soul of why I'm in this job. And what I realized is John Kasich believed it too. He looked at me and says, is your wife here? And I said, yeah, she's here. He says, she's down drinking sodas, I think. So an assistant goes down and gets Linda and brings her back to this end of the hall or the floor. And Governor Kasich stands up very appropriately, shakes Linda's hand, and then he starts to make a fist. And I've spent 3 hours with him, but I don't know him. I don't know what's going to happen. I know my loyalties to this lady right here. So I don't know what's going to happen. And he says, Linda, not talking to me, he's talking to Linda. He says, Linda, I know that we've spent 3 hours and we've debated and in some cases argued and a lot of things. I want Gary in his job. And it's going to be hard. He's got to save money. And I know in his heart he wants to reform what we're doing, and I want that too. And it's going to be hard. And about 2 months from now, you're going to be looking for me, and I'm not going to be available. So I'm going to give you the opportunity to rear back and hit me as hard as you can right now. True. She did not. Just for the record, she did not do that. At that moment, I accepted the call to do this responsibly. The problem was, this was December 27th. We were sworn in on January 4th. 7 days later, Linda's birthday, by the way. Just remember that. So we got to go to our place in Carolina for a few days, and quite frankly, God's divine plan came to me. And I've said it time and time again. People that work for me know I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. But during that time, this whole design of a prison system where if people were hurting people, we need to separate. Don't get me wrong. People that want to change, we want to wrap staff around them. Then ultimately, in the top tier, we want to create environments all over Ohio, our prisons, where people can grow, where people are busy 8 to 10 hours a day, and they're in various and sundry activities, and then we expect them to behave in the community because we can transition them to the community because we owe that to the taxpayers, we owe to the families, we owe to the neighbors. And we've stayed pretty true to that, haven't we? Stayed pretty true to that. So I accepted the position, and then I started to reflect just a little bit. I started to look back. You know, sometimes if you're in an environment for so long, you forget what color the wall's painted sometimes. So I became director, and I started to look back at my career, and I don't think I'm that old. Now, I know a lot of you do, but I don't think I'm that old. So I started to reflect what has happened during my career since July 1st, 1974 to today. And I want to talk about a few things that I think are important for you to hear. This is during my career. We had 7 prisons the day I started. We now have 27 prisons. We had 8,000 people incarcerated in Ohio's prisons the day I started. We now have 50,400. We had 291 women incarcerated the entire state of Ohio the day I started in my career. Today we have 4,200. The day I started, I was part of a workforce that represented 5.2% of all state employees worked for the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. Today it's 25%. 1 out of every 4 state employees works for us. If we looked at the population, you know, we take in 21,000 Ohioans because because they are human beings. Ohioans a year, and we release about 21,000 people back to live in your neighborhood. That's an important piece, folks, because I believe in my heart our job is to ensure that they have a chance, that they can smile, and that you're safe. Of those people coming to us, over 5,000 of these people, think about this, over 5,000 people coming to us a year have never in their entire life been arrested, indicted, or convicted of any act of violence. Over 5,000 people a year coming to prison with absolutely no history of violence. Most of those drug offenders. 20% of the people, as we look at the prison population today, and our prison population is 138% crowded. If you think about California, when the federal court took them over, we're 2 percentage points below that. That's it. 138% density. We have 10,600 people incarcerated in our prison, 20%, 10,600 that are mentally ill. We're the largest mental health provider in the country. And if we think about it, this has all been done while we've had the lowest rate of violent crime. And these are not Gary Moore's numbers, these are the FBI's numbers. The lowest rate of violent crime in Ohio since 1969. So we've grown, and I know that's hard to believe, and you're saying, you say, God, this guy's up giving us a message. He's got to be honest, but it is the truth. And all I can say is this. When I was going through my time growing up, we had Chet Long, Channel 10 News in Columbus, and we had Walter Cronkite, right? Had a half an hour local, half an hour of evening news. That was it. Wasn't a lot of time. They had to get to the point, get the big stories. Today at 4:26 every morning, 4:26 local news comes on in Columbus and is on throughout 10 o'clock in the morning. There's a lot of yellow tape. And if I were sitting in your shoes without having looked at these documents, I would believe that we have the worst violent crime rate we've ever had in our life. But it's not true. Hebrews 13:3, remember the prisoners as though in prison with them. Consider for just a moment how we all would feel, and maybe there's some in the room today that have experienced this, that have a loved one that may have been on pills that were prescribed for pain, that have drifted to heroin. 40% of heroin users today got started in their medicine cabinet. This is a terrible drug. One time, people can become addicted. One time. And one time, they can want heroin more than food. We see our prisons filled with these people. We know we did a great job in 2011 eliminating all of the pill mills and the doctors coming up from Florida prescribing all this stuff on the weekends and going back. But we didn't deal with the addiction. And people were turning to heroin, half the cost of these pills. And I spoke in Washington, D.C., and I'm speaking on a panel with a former drug czar for the country. And we shared a cab. We were going over to the same session. And I was excited because I love what we do. It's a calling. I love what we do. I love the fact that we're making a difference. And I was telling him all this stuff, and I was so excited. And he says, Gary, do it. Don't pilot anything. Your ideas are right. Go do all this stuff. And then he went on to tell me, he says, Gary, I'll tell you how important this war on drugs really is. Of anyone in the United States of America, he said, I should have known the signs. I should have known where to take folks. I lost my son to an overdose. It happens everywhere. So, what does that mean for us? What does it mean for us today? You know, on Maundy Thursday, Jesus was assembled with the disciples, and they were getting ready to celebrate Passover and the First Communion. And Jesus gave all of us a new commandment. Love, the commandment, that you love one another just as I have loved you. You also should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. And some folks, and I've been in a prison business 41 years, and I've seen some horrible, despicable acts. I was asked to lead the investigation of the riot in Lucasville. Saw some horrible things in my career. It's awfully easy to take a look at those despicable, horrible acts that can never be condoned and separate those people that did that from those people that are trying to turn their lives around. It's hard. It's hard for the staff. It's hard for the people in prisons to do that. But that's what we, I believe, are called to do. I think we're called first to open up our hearts and our minds to understand the truth. 5,000 people coming to us, mostly drug addicted, that have never committed any acts of violence, are coming to prison. And Brett, you know that a 6-month sentence in prison can be a life sentence because people can't get jobs. The electronic age, everybody can find out everything about someone, and people can't get jobs. I think second of all, it guides us in what we do in our business. We need to deal with this drug addiction. And folks, I think it's time that we deal with it effectively. And someone shouldn't have to go see a judge to be able to get treatment. And just because someone has seen a judge and someone hasn't seen a judge doesn't mean that they should be exclusively in different programs and separate that. We should be calling to be preventative. If people come to prison, we should ensure that the stuff that we do in prison is good stuff, and I'll tell you how good it is in a minute, and it's connected to the community, because addiction doesn't stop when you leave prison. It's a lifelong journey. We've got to get people ready for the workforce. We've got to train people. We've got to make sure people are ready, and we need to invite the community into our prisons and take a look at what we have to offer. Our training, the reintegration centers, and the fact that we offer, we drug test. It's hard for employers to find, but we drug test, and we train people, and it's important. Job is not just income, it's dignity that we have. We held a faith-based summit in Canton, and it was a great event. Brett was there, as he's everywhere with me, it seems. We had a lot of staff there. We had about 1,100 people there in Canton, Ohio, about faith-based prison ministries. 1,100 people in this mega church, and we're church, and I was up, and I didn't have notes, and I was, we were preaching. And we had an employer up there talking about what great success they've had in hiring our people and promoting our people, because they were able to go into our prisons and interview people and look at skills and then have us tell them the kind of individual they are based on their performance. We're able to do all of that. And he was talking about what a great resource that is. We had employers ready all wrapped around the room to interview people for jobs. We had all kind of workshops going on. And in the midst of that, and in the midst of walking off the pulpit, I had a person come to me and says, "Director, I work for you. One of my 12,000 plus, I work for you. I'm a dental assistant at Grafton. And I'm so enthused and so inspired. I want to do something more. What can I do?" Well, I know it may not seem like it because I've been talking a lot here, but I was at a loss for words. I didn't know. I was thinking about a lot of things, and finally it just came to me. I said, I don't know, but I know that if you look for it, you'll find it. I know that. And I think she was pretty disappointed. I could see it in her face. She turned and walked away. And what she did, she didn't walk away. She walked toward something. She walked toward the Salvation Army and a group of churches then with the Salvation Army. And they went to churches. And she was called to say, "Listen, I've seen the way these 41 years that Gary Moore's been in the system, I've seen the way we release our people from prison. 21,000 people from prison. We give them a set of sweat clothes and send them on their way with a little money to buy a bus ticket." And she knew in her heart that that wasn't right. And she knew that she had the ability to do that. So they went out and they started collecting clothing. And we had a vacant house up there that people used to live in. It's a big house. And all of a sudden, there wasn't just a line of clothes stacked up. There were racks and racks and rooms of clothes for both men and women being released from prison. So that when someone gets released from prison, they go there, they're given a leisure set of clothes, and are given a suit and tie. Some of it's used, most of it's used, and are given dresses so people can go out and interview for jobs and take care of the people, the families that have been out in their community, the kids and the wives and the spouses, the parents that have been keeping the lights on that house for them. They're able to go out and try to earn an income and dignity to help pay them back. she did that. And to folks to see the face, I saw the face, Brett saw the faces of people when the inmates getting ready to be released. They walked in, they were bewildered, I'm going to get out, I don't know what's going on. And when they put those clothes on, that smile and confidence that came in their face and their affect was, you knew they had a chance. And you knew that they were hopeful and thinking forward. You know, this day has meant more to me than anyone will ever understand. I didn't dream of this ever being here. This calling, this ability to serve the people that have gotten in trouble has been a lifelong calling and has been overwhelming in my life. And to see the people that are here and the people that serve every day and believe that our job is to turn folks back into our communities, 21,000 a year, that are better. And of those 21,000, by the way, 1,400 of those people are honorably discharged veterans going back into our community that have been in our care and custody. And I don't know what today will generate. I don't know. But from Andy Gerd and the Ohio State University Buckeyes and my relationship with Brett and that hour and a half conversation with Pastor David, you know, we're here today. And I just want to extend an invitation to all of you. If you have an interest in helping with this calling, to helping with what Brett does all the time, then we welcome you. And you're going to see great staff that would welcome you as well. I think the underpinning, as I go around the country, I think the foundational challenge that we have is we have too many people in the United States of America that don't understand that we have human beings that we're responsible for. And Ohio is different. I want to tell you and close with this. We are reforming our system. It's not the same system it was 4.5 years ago. We now have 12 reintegration units inside our prisons where people are working 8 to 10 hours a day in 11 different pathways, including the faith-based victim services that are dealing with their families, they're dealing with recovery, dealing with their jobs. 8 to 10 hours a day. We have inmates that get up at 5:30 in the morning, and Ronnie has them here at Marysville, that are making mats for the homeless to sleep on because they have nowhere else to sleep. And they even make children's mats for their children that have no place to sleep. They're up at 5:30 in the morning making these mats out of plastic grocery bags. Community service of all kinds going on. And what we've got going on August 22nd in Canton, we've had inmates painting these big panels. They're either 3x5 or 4x8 panels. And inmates have been painting artwork on this. And all of these panels are being delivered to Canton to put in these old, vacant, dilapidated buildings where all the windows are broken out to cover those up and to decorate and to support the communities in Canton, to make it beautiful, to demonstrate that there's caring, both outside and inside. I also know this. Some of us get paid for being able to come in and have the privilege of working with offenders. We are so thankful that we have volunteers that come in because that's a huge difference. That's one of the biggest differences, Brett, in Ohio than any other state. We have so many caring Ohioans that come in, and Ohio is different. If you look at people returning to prison, if you look at the national rate of people returning to prison across this country, it's 49.7. Now, I'm an elementary school teacher, but at least I can figure that's pretty darn close to 50%, right? In Ohio, it's 27.5. Now, those are percentages, but let's talk about human beings. Because of the great service and community support that we have and the great work of all these folks and about 11,990 others, because of all of that, 4,300 fewer Ohioans are returning to prison every year than if we were just at the national average. 4,300, and it's not just those offenders. It's for their families, their children, because because we know that the children of the incarcerated are 6 times more likely to come to prison than those that don't have a parent in prison. There's so many levels and dimensions that we have the opportunity to help, and I've been blessed to be able to be part of. And I hope that, there'll be some discussion afterwards, and we've got a tour on Tuesday at Marysville, a prison that was designed for about 1,200. We now have 2,800 inmates there, women, to see some remarkable things, to see faces, and to have the inmates lead you through the prison and talk about what's going on and how you can help. So we're going to be gathered afterwards to maybe talk about that. Thank you for an experience of my life that I'll never forget. Thanks for openly welcoming my family and our staff. We genuinely feel, David, very welcome here. Let's close with prayer.